Bonjour et bienvenue à la balado-diffusion du colloque « Éthique des médias, de l'information au marché » tenu à Montréal en avril 2009. Welcome to the audio podcast of the Media Ethics from Information to Markets Conference that took place in Montreal in April 2009.
Next speaker is Andrew Potter. Andrew Potter is the deputy managing editor for the news at the Ottawa Citizen newspaper. He's also a columnist for Maclean's magazine. He is the co-author of a bestseller, the book The Rebel Cell with Joseph Hirth. And it was a researcher a few years ago at the CREUM here in Montreal. And finally, he holds a PhD in philosophy from the University of Toronto.
Thanks. Well, this is good. I'm sort of, everything I sort of wanted to say is sort of, we've already sort of gotten, we're in the middle of things right now. So this discussion sort of follows, my paper sort of inserts itself into the middle of this discussion that we're having. So I'll try and keep what I have to say short. I won't sort of give you the whole 9 yards of it. I sort of have this sort of, not unique, but sort of a weird career path where I spent most of my intellectual life training to be an academic and then got dragged almost against my will into becoming a journalist. And one thing I found when I entered the newspaper business was realizing quite quickly that journalists have almost as high opinion of themselves and their role in a democratic society as humanities professors do. Which sort of surprised me a bit, because I didn't think it was possible to actually have that. But there are all these sort of things journalists say about themselves. There's this old line from, I think, Jefferson, where he says something to the effect that I would prefer newspapers without a government to a government without newspapers. There's the other things you've probably heard about what journalists say, but what they do. We afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. We speak truth to power. And the masthead of the Globe and Mail newspaper has this little slogan. I always get it wrong when I try and say it, but it's something to the effect of, the subject who is truly loyal will neither advise nor submit to arbitrary measures. And it's a quote from Junius, who I assume was somebody who said these kind of things once upon a time. Right, and so this whole idea, right, that we're in some sense have an adversarial relationship to the state, we're a check on arbitrary power, and these sorts of things. And one of the things that's sort of happening with the changing media landscape and everything that I don't have to sort of get into in great detail, but basically what seems to be the imminent demise of the news business, people are starting to become concerned not just that a business model and technology is disappearing and that that's bad for journalists, but that this is going to be in some way bad for democracy itself. And so what I want to do is just sort of lay out what I think are the three arguments that sustain this claim, that the demise of newspapers is actually bad for democracy, sort of just run through them and raise, I think, certain skeptical arguments. Because if the question of my talk is, or the question of the title is, are newspapers vital to democracy? My answer is, I don't know, but I don't think so. Perhaps that uncertainty is a function of the fact that I don't have time to read anything anymore because all I do is put out a newspaper. So you guys can tell me what I should think at the end of this. I started working in a newspaper about a year and a half ago, and within 3 months of me being there, they'd fired all the advertising VPs. Canwest had offered a buyout to the newsroom. A couple months later, they shut down an entire section of the newspaper called the Citizen Weekly, which was the place where we put all the long-form journalism. The editor-in-chief left. It wasn't replaced for a year and a half, and so on and so on and so on. It's been ever since I started. When I actually got offered the job, I asked two questions. How's the business doing? When can I start? And he saw the business doing great. He started away. Should have asked more questions, I think. The argument in favor of newspapers and the role of democracy has two premises to it. One is that the newspaper provides services or functions that are vital to the proper functioning of democracy. Second premise is when the newspaper disappears, those services either will not or cannot be performed by successor media. So therefore, democracy will suffer in a post-newsprint world. So that's the argument. It's worth, I think, flagging at the beginning just what a newspaper is. And a newspaper is a fusion of two things. First of all, it's a technology. It's a media delivery technology that is actually quite ancient. I mean, it's been around for over 150 years. And actually, it's one that I actually really like. And one of the great rushes of actually working in the news business is at the end of a long day, for instance, the federal election or instance, you sort of walk upstairs to the press. Citizen is one of the few places left where the presses are actually in the building in which the newsroom is. And so at the end of the day, you can go upstairs and just watch them when the presses start running at 11:30, and you can grab them as they come off the conveyor belt. And it's you feel like it's 1950. You should be wearing a hat and a visor and everything, get ink on you. But that's what it's a technology for delivering content. And it's a very old and quite inefficient technology for delivering content. But it's also a business model. And the business model that's been sort of fused to that and grafted onto it is the framing of ads in context. So we have the content that we deliver to you, we frame ads in context on that and sell those ads to advertisers. So it takes this content delivery mechanism, fuses a business model of delivering eyeballs to advertisers, and for well over 100 years made buckets of money. Newspapers were stupendously profitable, margins over 30% for year after year after year after year after year. It was great. That's rapidly falling apart. I mean, I think 3 years ago, Arthur Sulzberger, the owner of The Times, said something effective, I don't know if The New York Times is going to be publishing in 5 years or not, but I don't really care because we're this great media brand, blah, blah, blah. And I think people thought he was exaggerating when he said 5 years, and certainly that's not looking like an exaggeration anymore with newspapers starting to fall like 10 pins. So what has happened exactly, right? I mean, because it's not clear what has happened, why newspapers didn't, because obviously it's obvious what the problem is. The problem is the internet. But it's not obvious why the newspaper business model couldn't just be sort of shoved onto the internet content, ads sold in context, watch the buckets of money continue to roll in. And I think and it's one thing that newspaper owners don't really understand either. I mean, it's only in the past year people have realized this business model is not going to work. And I think the model I've sort of got in my head of trying to figure out what exactly has happened is the model of the department store. Think about what a department store was. It was just one big building where you had a whole bunch of things that didn't really belong together, right? You had a clothing department and a shoe department and maybe a photography studio, a wedding registry, kitchen, bathware, all kinds of stuff, different floors, cosmetics. Anything you could want to buy was in this one building. And for a long time, it was a fantastic business model. And then gradually, society got richer, division of labor took over, the department store just got pulled apart. And the shoe department became Nike World, the clothing department became The Gap, the coffee shop became Starbucks, right? It became entire sectors. And so while it's true that the Bay is more or less non-existent anymore, Sears doesn't really work anymore as a business model, Woolworths doesn't work as a business model anymore, does that mean that nobody wants to buy stuff anymore? Obviously not, right? I mean, look around, right? If anything, people are consuming more of all of these kind of things they used to consume in department stores. And the quality is better, the quantity is better, the selection is better, all kinds of things. The demise of the department store has been a boon for the consumer in a lot of ways. And I think if you consider what the newspaper is, it was basically a department store of media. All the stuff that really didn't belong together except the fact that it was the kind of thing that could be delivered on newsprint and some people wanted to buy. Horoscopes, sports scores, Sudoku, world news, local news, opinions, all these kind of things we throw together and so on. And frankly, off the cuff, when I started at the business, I was talking to one of my reporters and I said, oh, this story, blah, 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 do you think this will sell a lot of papers? He goes, as long as we get the horoscopes and the crossword, people buy the paper, right? It really doesn't matter what goes on. And it's actually kind of embarrassingly true. The most mail we get, last weekend at the Citizen, we published the Sudoku. We published every number in every box. We published the answer, right, basically. And we got flooded with mail, right? It's like, oh, you know, got the Sudoku wrong. Oh, well, good thing they didn't read the news. So what's happened to the newspaper? It's been pulled apart by online media. The opinion pages became blogs. The world news became aggregators. The local pages became basically local city blogs that are springing up all over the place. You get Sudoku whatever you want. You've got sports blogs. So you have all of these online media, and the big moneymaker, classified ads, has gone to Craigslist, right? So every aspect of the newspaper has been tugged apart, disaggregated, and put online in a much more efficient way, often free to most people. And that's what's broken about the business model of newspaper, is that you can't put the newspaper online anymore. In the same way, you can't really reconstitute the Bay or Sears and this stuff. It's just the business model is broken. And you'll hear a lot of people saying we need to fix the business model. The business model isn't going to be fixed. I think that's fundamentally the fact, because there's nothing really to fix anymore. Technology moved on and made the old business model obsolete. So where does that leave us with respect to democracy? Well, there are three claims that are made about the old newspaper's relevance to or vital role within democracy. Three that I've come across. There are probably others. One I'll call the dependency argument. A second, which I'll call the Watergate ideal. And the third is the concern over what we can call the daily me. So the three of them are the dependency argument, the Watergate model, and the daily me worry. So the dependency argument, it's pretty straightforward, and I think a great version of it was given by a Toronto columnist named John Kay in the National Post a while ago called "You'll Miss Us When We're Gone." Right? Certain amount of special pleading there, but the argument simply was, all of you people out there, you bloggers, you citizen journalists, you aggregators, and so on, we're the ones providing the content that you're commenting on or linking to, and so on. Once we're gone, you're not going to like it. So that's basically the dependency argument. Everything that goes on online, so goes the argument, depends ultimately on the activities of real journalists. And when they go under, what exactly will the bloggers and so on have to talk about? Well, not much. So that's one of the arguments. The second one is the Watergate argument, and it goes back to this ideal that journalists have about themselves and what they do. Comes from Bernstein and Woodward, this idea that somehow journalists are the ultimate checks on government malfeasance, fraud, lying, and other forms of arbitrary power and its exercise. And David Simon, who some of you might know as the guy who wrote most of The Wire, was a former journalist in Baltimore, wrote a piece in, I believe, Slate or The Atlantic. It's a problem with online. I never know where I read anything anymore, right? It's like I read this somewhere. I read Drudge, right? But I think it was in The Atlantic, where he gave this description of what it was like being a cop beat reporter back in the 80s. And he said, here's how we kept tabs on the government. I walked out, put on my running shoes, took my tape recorder and maybe a pen, and started asking the police chief questions. Around, I asked some questions, and I would read some of the data about arrest rates and conviction rates, and I would sort of dig in a bit. I would research. So this idea that gumshoe journalism, the very sort of straightforward variety, was in a lot of ways a very effective check on the police. We knew when they were lying to us because we would go and run their numbers. We would ask other questions and sort of just do run of the mill journalism, which he claims was actually a vital part of serving as a check on local authorities. So that's the second one. The third argument about the disappearance of newspapers comes from, you see it around in various places. The most sophisticated version of it is found in Cass Sunstein's work. He wrote a book called Republic 2.0, and he's written a number of articles about this. And it's the idea that we're getting group polarization online. So the argument is the old newspapers, because of the logic of mass circulation and so on, they would pull together a lot of diverse views, a lot of diverse ideas, stuff from all over the place, designed to appeal to as many readers as possible. And so even if you went there, say, for Frank Rich's column, you might get, you get Tom Friedman, you might get Paul Krugman, right? So you get exposed to, by happenstance, the happenstance of just turning the pages over, you get exposed to things you didn't even know you were interested in, you didn't really realize you thought you'd like. And so this fostered, so goes the claim from Sunstein, the democratic values of curiosity and openness and tolerance. And the concern is these are also democratic virtues, openness, tolerance, commitment to diversity. These are democratic virtues. And that those virtues that are fostered simply by reading a newspaper, if the newspaper goes away, they won't be fostered as well, and democracy will be harmed. And why doesn't that happen online? Well, he says that what happens is a form of what he calls group polarization, which is the idea that when you get a whole lot of people of like-minded ideological positions speaking just amongst themselves, they end up at the end of the day, at the end of the conversation, with views that are much more radically polarized than the ones they went in with. I'm sure most people are probably familiar with that Sunstein's argument on that. Now, I think there's something to this. Group polarization is a fairly widely observed phenomenon. It explains, to a certain extent, why fraternities are so sexist. It explains why journalists drink so much, I think, to a certain extent. There's all kinds of things about people's behavior and ideas they have that can be explained by a certain amount of radicalization in the inside of these groups. And Sunstein seems to think that online it's going to be a lot more pernicious. The group polarization will be a lot more pernicious. Why? Because of what he calls the daily me, you will only be exposed to the views of people you already have, and that they will sort of echo back and forth and end up in this much more hysterical pitch than anyone started out with. And the example he gives at one point, one of the articles I saw him read on this was, he talks about a website called the Daily Kos. Anyone familiar with this? Is that how you pronounce it? Is it Kos? Kos? Anyway. A democratic, liberal democratic blog in the United States. And he says, a recent survey showed that 80% of the readers of the Daily Kos are Democrats, and fewer than 1% are Republicans. And there's a recently launched version of this for the right called Fox Nation, which you can check out if you'd like. It has things like the actress Angie Harmon from NYPD, Law and Order, defending Sarah Palin, other things like this, right? Anyway, it's a right-wing version of the same kind of thing. And the idea is, says Sunstein, that the result of the group polarization that will happen online will be serious obstacles, he says as a quote, not merely to civility, but also to mutual understanding and democracy itself. So you put these three worries together, the dependency argument, the Watergate argument, and the daily me argument, and you end up with this view that, or this worry that nobody's doing any actual reporting anymore. Nobody's doing any actual investigating anymore. And everyone is just yelling about amongst themselves with their sort of half-baked, ill-informed opinions. These big echo chambers. So you get this sort of idiocracy of ignoramuses trying to run a democracy, which is quite obviously or supposedly impossible. It all sounds quite terrible. Now, I have to say, I don't take some of these I take more seriously than others. The Daily Me worry, actually, even though it's the most sophisticated version of the argument, I actually think it's probably the least worrisome for a pretty straightforward reason, which is that there's no evidence I've seen that this is the way people behave online. In fact, most of the recent Pew Project in Excellence in Journalism study showed that actually people don't want that. In fact, what they find about their newspapers is that they're not getting the variation of variety they want, and that they're going online in search of it. If you go to the Pew website or the PEJ website, you can sort of find the data on all of this. But also, there's a point which, you know, is worth pointing out, which it shouldn't be surprising that 80% of people who go to visit the Daily Kos are Democrats, any more than it should be surprising that, you know, most people who visit McDonald's like hamburgers, right? That's why they're there. The worrisome thing would be if people only ate at McDonald's, right? Or if people only visited the Daily Kos. And I certainly haven't seen the evidence that that's the case. That in people's sort of media grazing habits that they're doing this for the most part. A second, I think, sort of deeper objection is one, and I sort of flagged it briefly yesterday in sort of my exchange with Darren Barney, and it's too bad he's not here today, because it's worth pointing out that this is a surprising argument for people on the left to be making, given what was said about newspapers for a very long time. Think back, how many people here have seen the movie Manufacturing Consent? The one about Noam Chomsky, right? Who's the big villain in that? What's the big media villain responsible for manufacturing a certain sort of consent for the system of... It's the New York Times, right? The very same newspaper, which everyone's saying right now, like, oh, we've got to save the New York Times, right? Like, because for democracy. This is a paper that for ages was seen as the symbol of manufactured consent for a system in which we are all being sort of inculcated, and it's not really democratic. It's a simulacrum of democracy. And what everyone was waiting for was the birth of a new media that would allow anyone with a laptop and an internet connection to spring up and publish and say whatever they wanted, right? Along it comes, 10 years later, everyone's like, oh, geez, democracy, right? Democracy's getting wrecked by all these people talking. And it sounds uncharitable, but you might want to say, you know, the left is never happy, right? Like, they got exactly what they wanted, which is basically anyone could become a journalist and a publisher against the old gatekeepers of the media. And suddenly it's the old media that are somehow we're all nostalgic for. And I think, at a certain point, I'm just tempted to just leave it at that and point out the blatant contradiction there, which is that, you know, people sort of change their minds. What's that? I can't see that. 5 minutes? Okay. Well, we'll just leave it there then, so we can talk about it. The other arguments about... whether anyone will do any more reporting and anyone will do any more investigation, I think, are probably more serious. And I'll run through really quickly a few points. One is, some people have said what we need are new business models, philanthropic organizations that will step in. Like, there's one called ProPublica, which is a philanthropic investigative journalism house that's being run by the former managing editor of the Wall Street Journal, in New York. There are citizen journalism projects springing up everywhere. Some people are saying newspapers should become like sports teams, where you just have these sort of rich guys who will like run them into the ground eventually. That might work in the short term. I'm skeptical of a lot of the citizen journalism stuff as a way of sort of stepping into the void. For a reason that I think speaks to the essence of what it means to be a journalist. And here's something we've sort of danced around and haven't really sort of, we've addressed it as a question but not really sort of settled on anything. Like, what is a journalist? What distinguishes a journalist from what everyone else does? Let me put this out there. A journalist is someone who makes phone calls. I think that's the one thing I learned working at a newspaper as opposed to what everyone else does. Because when I first started with my reporters, I'd assign them a story, and they'd go, okay. I figured they would call someone, write a paragraph down. And then they'd come around noon, and they'd be like, okay, I'm going for lunch, I'll be back in 2 hours. Like, well, how's your story going? I haven't written a word yet. Well, what do you got? They got, oh, I made like 20 calls, and they come back a few hours later and wait for the calls to come in. And what journalists do is they make phone calls, and journalists don't write anything that can't be validated by basically a phone call they have for some documents they have and so on. And I think to the extent to which we're going to run out of the kind of people who will make phone calls as opposed to engage in half-baked speculation about various things, journalism will suffer. The field of journalism will suffer. We will have a much diminished source online or wherever it happens of the kind of information that journalists who make phone calls provide. The further question is, democracy going to suffer if journalism suffers? And that's the leap that I'm not convinced of. Partly because I'm not convinced journalism is as intimately connected to democracy as most journalists seem to think it is. And there are a number of reasons for this. One is historical. I think the newspapers for a very long time didn't really do the kind of journalism that we think right now is vital to democracy. The 19th century newspapers, and the newspapers that Jefferson might have sort of thought were necessary, it would be unintelligible to us. Like, they were highly, highly partisan scandal sheets. 19th century newspapers were disgusting, right? Certainly not servants of truth or the public record or anything like that. They started wars. They did all kinds of horrible things. The other argument is that I'm skeptical about newspapers, even in the 19th century, doing anything other than I mean, we like to say they're brokers of civic engagement. Yeah, well, you know, the flip side of being a broker of civic engagement is saying that basically you were a gatekeeper of knowledge. And that gatekeeping function was being done by people who had no training or expertise in other than the fact that they owned the presses or, you know, happened to have certain opinions and money. And the last point is that there's a certain amount of special pleading involved here by journalists. I mean, most of the people complaining about the demise of newspapers are journalists themselves whose jobs are on the line and that has to be taken into consideration. So the upshot is, if we don't need healthy newspapers and even healthy journalists for democracy, what do they need? Let me just put this out really quickly. I won't argue for it because I'm running out of time. But I think given a strong multi-party system, given local representatives with proper mechanisms of accountability, given an independent judiciary, strong institutions of civil society, NGOs in particular, but also other civil society institutions who will start their own websites and do their own sort of investigations and so on, and a free media scape in which people can get online, start a blog and yell and link and do all these kind of things. Given all of those, do we need people making phone calls? It would be nice. As a consumer of news, it would be nice. As a democratic citizen, I'm not persuaded.
That was great. I was glad to see you swerve to the 19th century papers at the end, because my question was going to be about looking for empirical evidence in the right place. And it struck me that over the last couple of days, we've hinted at this theme of the role of the media in democracy. But we've been talking about Canada, the U.S., and Australia, you know, three very old, very robust, very stable democracies, which seems like an odd place to look for. So my question is, do you know anything, or do you have any thoughts on the idea that we should be looking at the role that newspapers either are or aren't playing in nascent or teetering democracies, right? Those are the places I'd be curious to know, you know, something I'm terribly uninformed about, but what's the role of a free press in, you know, nameable, you know, just start with Afghanistan and Iraq and all kinds of other places where democracy is either on the edge, either on its way in or on its way out. That's where we should look for some evidence about, you know, does something like the modern newspaper really matter to fostering democracy? Is it the sort of thing, in other words, if we didn't already have them, we'd have to invent them?
That's a great question. Something, it's funny, when I told some colleagues, one of my reporters, I was coming to give this talk, and I told him the title, he goes, well, that's a no-brainer. And I thought he agreed with me, right? No, right? And he's like, of course, right? And I said, ah. And he goes, well, the Soviet Union. And he started listing all these places where there aren't free presses. And I guess my instinct on this is to think, well, totalitarian governments aren't totalitarian because they don't have a free press, right? They don't have a free press because they're totalitarian. And what the link is, the causal linkages, I don't know, is a straightforward answer. I'd be interested in knowing. I mean, it's true that governments that want to remain in power limit the free press. Does that mean that if the free press disappears, that democracy, a pre-existing democracy, becomes impossible or something? I don't know. You know, people have, you know, let me know. The one thing that is interesting is there's a group in Vancouver. Does anyone know? I think they're called Compass. Like this, they. Do you know about this group? They do. They send journalists to recently freed up countries in the third world and so on, and sort of teach their reporters how to do actual sort of North American style reporting, right? Because what they're used to doing is doing samizdat, government stinks, bring down the government stuff, and so they need to learn how to make calls and be sort of basically objective journalists. But I don't know. I'd be happy to hear what other people have to say on that.
All right. Well, thank you. That was a really interesting presentation. I really like the way that you really describe what are journalists from your eyes of a philosopher, considering the experience you have in the newspaper. So I had the impression that there was two important questions in your talk. So the first one was, are newspapers vital for democracy? And the other one is, are journalists vital for democracy? And so what you said on your... Well, you kind of say no to the two question. So I think the first no is kind of convincing, but I'm not sure that the second no is convincing also. And I kind of miss you at the a little bit of what you said at the end of your talk, so maybe I've missed some of your arguments. But I'll try to give you one example, one reason why journalists are still vital for democracy. So in his book, Kassenstein, in his book, he talks about a group polarization as a problematic effects of information technology. But he also really talks about information cascade as a problematic effects of information technology. So I think you're right when you say that it's really hard to prove that the group polarization is a real problem in the cyberspace. But information cascade might be a more realistic problem. And so journalists might be people that only make phone calls, but maybe making phone calls is one of the best way to break these information cascades.
I didn't want to say journalists only make phone calls. I actually think like that's the essence of the journalist professional ethic, to the extent to which journalists are professionals. I think journalists make phone calls is the vital differentia between them and what everyone else does. So I wouldn't say merely. And you're right. I'm much less worried. I mean, the demise of the newspaper, that's the demise of a business model. And we should never mistake a business model for an institution of democracy, right? And so I have absolutely no concern about the demise of newsprint and that technology. Whether people are around to make calls, I guess the question is, we'd have to answer the following question, right? One, is that function important in democracy? And if people stop doing it, are there things that, will it not be replaced, or will that function not be replaced in certain ways? And it may be. People just might start making calls on their own in the way of citizens might learn how to do journalism on their own. I don't think that's the case, because right now, one of my reporters can call up a minister and say, I'm calling from the Ottawa Citizen, right? If you call them and say, I'm calling from my basement in my underwear, right? They're not going to, all right, well, I don't take calls from people in their underwear. I actually have sort of, not utopian views, but I think things are going to change in a really substantial way in the next 15 or 20 years in a way that we actually don't know. Let me give one example of something that might serve as a new institution of accountability. Take the case of Bernie Madoff. Right, the guy who stole everyone's money. There was a guy, he has a Greek name, who had all the documents on him for years. Does anyone know the name? Necropolis? Macropolis. Oh, Macropolis, not Necropolis, yeah. Macropolis, something like that. He had documents forever that he had sent to the SEC over and over again, and I believe he'd even met with journalists, and they'd kind of been, I don't see a story here. And Tyler Cowen, The Economist, mentioned on his blog, what if Macropolis had just simply taken those documents, started an anonymous blog, and put them up, and started promoting the blog around various economics blogs in the finance community? If all these documents he had about Madoff, would that have gotten people's attention? I think so, right? I think that would have been a far more effective tool for handling the Madoff situation than trying to go through the official channels of getting the attention of an overworked SEC investigators and overworked and under intellectualized journalists and so on. That's just one sort of sliver of idea of the way things could be going. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know, but it's certainly a mechanism for accountability of a sort.
I found that extremely interesting. Thanks for your presentation. I'm glad you mentioned David Simon. I'm a big fan of The Wire. If anyone here who's interested in media ethics hasn't seen HBO's The Wire, it's required viewing, especially season 5 about the newsroom, etc. It's interesting because David Simon made an additional point. I didn't read that Atlantic article you referred to, but he indicated when he left the Baltimore Sun in 1995, that was after a long series of buyouts of a number of different journalists. And what he indicated was he doesn't necessarily blame the internet for the decline of journalism per se. He says, you know, the past 20 or 30 years, all these major newspapers have gone through a series of cost-cutting measures. And a lot of the institutional memory that these newspapers built up are now gone. So in other words, people who knew City Hall, knew how to pick up the phone and find out what was really going on at City Hall around a particular issue, essentially left because the economic model wasn't there anymore. So that I think is worrisome. The other problem I have with, and the role of newspapers in democracy is, newspapers, for instance, I'm from Toronto. The Toronto Star has as its mission to try and represent the oppressed groups, or not necessarily oppressed groups, but those with economic clout. So, for instance, they did an investigative series recently about Filipino nannies not having adequate health care, pay, etc. And if newspapers go away or disappear, there's an example of a type of journalism that's probably not going to get produced in the future, right? It's not overly sexy. It's not going to sell a lot of copy. But it's a vital function in democracies to go send a reporter out there for a year, give them benefits and a decent salary, so they can investigate these stories that otherwise might not get enough attention. So eventually there was enough public pressure, the Ontario government started to make changes for undocumented workers, etc. So that, I think, is the danger in having newspapers disappear, is that getting those stories into the common weal, that foundations or people paying through PayPal on a particular website, that economic model just won't be able to survive down the road, I think. But anyway, I thought I'd throw that out there.
Yeah, that's really good. I think the first point quickly, I think speaks about what David Simon said about the loss of institutional memory. It speaks directly to Lisa Marie's point earlier about is there a something that you get lost when you start switching to freelance work? Yeah, you get the failure of a beat, which is someone who knows a beat and has been there for years and sort of knows who to talk to, knows what kind of questions to ask and so on. And we're suffering from that at The Citizen right now. We're using freelancers to cover courts right now, which I don't have to tell you is a disaster, right, from the perspective of covering it properly. It's they're talented and they're good journalists, but they just don't know courts the way they ought to. With respect to the other question, it's well taken, and I don't want to be sort of insouciant about the demise of newspapers. Lining the editor-in-chief's wall at my paper are basically a whole bunch of pictures of MPs holding up the copy of the Ottawa Citizen and braiding the government, right, over a headline of some sort, right? And this is when we insert ourselves into the process and think, yeah, that's right, we really are a fourth estate here, a democracy. Yeah, it's well taken. And like I said, my answer is I don't know if the newspaper is going to have huge. I think we'd have to have a big, long conversation about just what democracy is. And yeah, those stories will disappear, and it will affect our civic life in a certain way. And you're right, it might eventually affect the way our democracy functions. Maybe those stories will find some other way of coming out. Yeah. I don't know.
It cuts actually in both ways. So, who here knows about Iraq Body Count, the website?
Yeah.
Yeah, Iraq Body Count simply emerged as the place to go to find out, a conservative, reliable count of how many people were killed over the course of the years of war in Iraq. And it was started by activists and advocates. It was completely grassroots. They achieved credibility, and they actually hit star status because they became the official site to go to, where newspapers would cite them because it was the most reliable place for it. What they relied on, and their methodology, which was a fairly conservative methodology, was they wouldn't list a death unless two reputable news, traditional news sources had reported on that death. So they were piggybacking on top of the standard old newspapers or wire services, but they were doing something that the standard newspapers and wire services were simply unable to, or either unable or unwilling to do, either because they didn't have the scale or because they didn't have the proper, the motivation of the activists. And here we have a marvelous example about how just a shoestring bunch of activists become extraordinarily credible through new media, but parasitic on the old media. And the puzzle is, could they have pulled it off after the demise of the wire services and one can imagine a model where they could have become aggregators of more of credible local reporters, but that requires a certain leap of faith.
Yeah, and that does cut both ways, right? Because it's on the one hand, it speaks to the ability of online media to come up with new sort of models for presentation of data, but also the piggybacking effect. And this is where I scale back my claims about who cares, right? The newspapers disappear. I think what matters more, I mean, it's worth pointing out that the reason why the Ottawa Citizen used to have foreign bureaus, and every little small newspaper had someone in Washington and all this. It wasn't out of great commitment to democracy. It was a competitive pressure combined with a certain level of technological advancement that made various forms of sharing and so on impossible, right? There was a competitive advantage to having that. Now, I actually think that it's less important, but it remains important that... Basically, here's what I think. As long as there's a New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, the Globe and Mail, and a handful of other global organizations in a reasonably competitive global media environment, things will be fine. And that's kind of the upshot of it.
I just wanted to go back quickly to the previous question. Maybe what you called, I think, the Watergate argument. Maybe the most prominent case of investigative journalists we got in Canada was the sponsorship scandal. And my only question was... It was a long, tedious work, and it could not be done by volunteer journalists. So what will replace if that kind of journalist that I think we can agree is serve a purpose in democracy? So in this precise case, what can replace investigative journalists? Even though I tend to agree with you that there's a problem with the business models, and journalists tend to give themselves a great deal of importance, but in precise case where you need a long and tedious work to bring out the news. What can be done in this case?
Actually, to newspapers is due to the fact that I like having coffee when I read the news, and I'm afraid of spilling coffee on my computer. And if that's you know, surely somebody will come up with a fix for that, right? But on the other hand, journalists. So, are there journalists because they're newspapers, or are there newspapers because they're journalists?
That's a very good question.
And you know, my intuition is the latter, and that you know the energies that go into putting stories into the Ottawa Citizen or the New York Times will go into, you know, and that might be just a Pollyanna-ish optimistic view. But, you know, I mean, I think there's already some pretty good reporting going on online, like reporting, not piggybacking on other people's reporting, but, you know, if there's already some pretty good reporting going on online. You know, you mentioned Slate, there's Salon, you know, there's a lot of places to go out there where you can already see where the people would go if it turns out that, you know, they show up at the Ottawa Citizen tomorrow and the padlock's on the door.
Yeah, and here's where I sort of undercut my whole argument, right, by sort of conceding the point, which is that I think one of the things that drives a lot of this, and something that didn't really come up in the discussion, and that you only sort of realize working in a newspaper, journalists don't do what they do out of any desire to, like, make money for their employer. That's not why my reporters go out and dig up stories. They get up stories, and not even necessarily to beat the competition, because they don't really know what the competition is working on, right? They want to beat their fellow reporters in the newsroom. Why? Because newsprint is a budget constraint. And getting in the paper is and getting higher up in the news hole is a form of status. And so... I think there's to a certain extent that we have the kind of journalism we do, I think, because we have the kind of media we do. The media technology, the newspaper, is a certain kind of thing that requires a certain type of journalism to get up high. And the trick will be wondering whether there will be people who will want to do that kind of thing in the absence of the constraint of a news whole budget. Is there another kind of status competition that can operate? Yeah, web hits. Yeah, exactly. Top on Drudge. You know, that's an interesting question to sort of anyone looking for a journalism thesis. There you go. There's one right there. Thanks.